That's the first movement of a four-movement quartet for woodwinds by Jean Francais in a performance by the Illinois Woodwind Quintet, all of whose members are faculty at the University of Illinois School of Music. They are flutist Jonathan Keeble, oboist John Dee, clarinetist J. David Harris, and bassoonist Timothy McGovern. And the oboist, John Dee, is going to be giving his own solo recital. It's solo with some other faculty members and some other performers as well tomorrow night at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, which starts at 7:30. He'll be my guest on Live and Local today. Live and Local is your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly, and thank you very much for joining us on the show. And thanks to John Dee for joining us.
Pleasure, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
I guess you've been on here a couple of times, maybe before in advance of recitals or other things going on. And I've always certainly enjoyed your playing. And it's always good to, I think, highlight what faculty artists are doing, because so much of the time people don't know what they're doing. I think people, certainly in Champaign-Urbana, tend to forget, if they were ever aware in the first place, that faculty artists perform solo and perform in ensembles. And then, of course, there are all these wonderful student groups as well that give public performances, and people don't always turn up for them.
It's true. We have so many high-caliber performers on our faculty, and we have concerts all throughout the year. And we are currently in an initiative at the School of Music to publicize more, outreach more, and let people know what's happening in a bigger way, a more clear platform for schedules and getting people onto campus, because it has been something of a almost a secret, a great secret, and we'd like to get it out. When the public comes out to hear the students play their recitals, it means so much to them, and the public can see very quickly at the high level of student performance that we have here at the University of Illinois. It's rather remarkable. So we'd like to showcase that. And so I think that you'll see in the next year, Kevin, especially thanks to you for having me on the show today, having my colleagues on, and making mention of it and being the voice for the School of Music so that people do know when things are occurring, like my recital tomorrow night at the Krannert Center. It means an awful lot, and I think that working together in partnership will make that more and more clear in the future and get people out and involved at the School of Music with all these wonderful performances.
And, of course, everybody who's on faculty here has a pedigree of some sort, meaning that you've done things to warrant the university's deciding to hire you as faculty members. Before you were here, you were Principal Elbow of the Florida Philharmonic and Florida Grand Opera. What town were those in?
That's that was the largest arts organization in Florida and roughly equivalent to Atlanta in terms of the budget and the size of the scope. In fact, we had more ticket sales than any orchestra in the country, and it was Miami. It was all the way up through Palm Beach, so Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Boca Raton, Palm Beach, that 150-mile stretch of southeastern coast of Florida. And so we played, unlike the Chicago or Cleveland orchestra that might play three repeats or two or three concerts a week, we'd have to repeat that four or five times because we had beautiful halls that were built in Miami and Boca and Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach and another western area that we would go and play each of our concert sets in. And, of course, with the opera company, the Miami Opera was ranked fifth in the country for a long time, and it maintains a very busy schedule. So that was very similar to the Houston Grand Opera / Symphony Orchestra contract where we would do both orchestras. So artfully wise, it was very good to be able to be in the opera pit as well as on the stage. For the orchestra, I think the orchestra benefited greatly in an artful sense to be able to accompany and do the things a great opera orchestra does at the same time to be able to get up and make its own recordings on stage as a philharmonic. So it was a very busy time and a wonderful high-level product that people, as you undoubtedly know, the Southeast Florida is filled with Northeast people who come down and live much of the year. So the standards are high. If they're not at Carnegie Hall and they're down in the Miami Performing Arts Center or up in Palm Beach, they expect to hear the same quality, and they were certainly getting it with the Florida Philharmonic.
What you mentioned, being able to play in both an opera pit and on stage with the orchestra. For an oboist, what's the difference? What are some of the rewards of one that perhaps the other doesn't provide and then the other way around?
Well, first, the opera is just some of the best repertoire that is known to man. It's just gorgeous repertoire.
Which you mean just musical repertoire, period, or having some of the best oboe?
Oh, both, repertoire. Actually. Some of the finest solos, some of the finest work, and in collaboration with some of the finest vocalists in the world. Pavarotti, for example, did his start in Miami and consequently came back many, many times. He was a hometown favorite, and he just always remembered where he started and who gave him his first break. So we saw a lot of him. And I think that as an art form, you just can't beat opera for being able to express yourself with the solos that you're given, in my case for the oboe or any of the instruments, at the same time to be the singer in essence, and then to be able to accompany a vocalist, which is to many of us instrumentalists the epitome of music making, and to be able to be with those wonderful stars, whether it's Domingo or Carreras or Pavarotti or any number of those people that we worked with all the time, and to hear them perform and do their art, and then to try to emulate and to work with that and collaborate with that, is such a high level of training that it then transforms itself onto stage when you're doing a Tchaikovsky 4 with the symphony orchestra, and again you're the vocal soloist at the beginning of the second movement with that beautiful oboe solo or so, and you view music differently, I think, when you've gone through an opera orchestra, and the textures that are required and how you have to be able to play soloistically but behind someone else. It's not always, you know, your show, and in fact it's just very collaborative. I think, as you know, the chamber situation, we educate our students here to play in chamber groups. We coach them each week. We work very diligently on people listening to one another and to collaborating sonically, intonation, pitch, balance. And that translates itself right into the orchestra section and right onto the stage, whether we're working with vocalists or we're working with our wind sections or with strings. So it's all, in a way, it's all the same type of discipline, but depending on the nature of the group and the repertoire, how you apply it.
Do you think that operatic composers tend to write more vocally for the orchestra than orchestral composers, those who basically do one or the other?
Well, I think certainly the great operatic composers, they knew what a melody was, and they knew how to shape it and form it and delve it out between the various instruments. That's a very, very good question. I just have to think that since vocal is such a major part of the opera, that the answer would be yes. They knew how to write so well for the voice that anything they did into the instrumental parts reflected that as well. But then the argument would be, look at the beautiful lines in Brahms symphonies or serenades of Brahms or the Mozart serenades for winds. And again, is it vocal? Yeah, it could well be. I think what we talk to there is perhaps just the quality of the composer and the quality of their writing. I think anything that is truly beautiful is vocal or should be vocal in nature. So that's how I perceive my job to some degree on the oboe, is trying to get my voice communicated to the audience through a musical line. And that to me is most important, the communication skills involved. So I think that's the type of thing I try to teach my students too, is being a convincing communicator. And so we work a lot on the air. We work a lot, like I've gone to lots of master classes with vocal or string master classes. I find them fascinating for how I can draw parallels to what we do, and the parallels are evident. Creating a line and shaping, just like someone would shape clay on a turning wheel. You shape it the same way, and how you use your air, just like how you use the bow, or how you create vibrato as a vocalist through the diaphragm, and the same thing with the oboe. So we have so many connections to be made that it's fascinating. It's wonderful work. I recommend it to anybody.
Which part, music or oboe playing?
Music and oboe playing. Anyone who wants to sign up to play the oboe, come see John D. at the University of Illinois. Glad to get you involved.
Well, let's hear an example of, I'm going to say, vocal performance, so to speak, although I haven't actually heard this piece before. You just said it's particularly lyrical. This is one by the wonderful composer of Anonymous. James Galway made sort of a joke about that when he was here last week with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, and I wish I could remember what the joke was because it was kind of funny. Nonetheless, this is called Lilies on the Mountainside. So Anonymous from what period?
This is actually a piece that I picked up I'm probably the only one who owns it, and it's a piece that I picked up in China when I was playing with the Hong Kong Philharmonic, and I went off into a corner, into a sort of a bookstore, and I found this music, and I was just fascinated by it. It might have been originally written for a treble instrument or an erhu or something of that nature, where it was just meant to be sung through, in terms of an instrument, a treble voice. And I've adapted it for the oboe. But Anonymous, it seems to me that it's that piece that we're going to play now is Lilies on the Mountainside. I have a few others in the collection. I think they were all built on Chinese folk tunes. And they seem to be, and the audience will be able to interpret this as well as you or me, which is they seem to be written in a Western style. It's as if the melodies came from folk tunes, but then they were put down by someone who had studied Western music. You'll see what I mean when we play it.
Lilies on the Mountainside, wonderful, sort of characteristic of a lot of Chinese folk tunes. They're very descriptive in their names. And it's oboist John Dee performing with anybody, or is this just you solo?
This is with piano. And
this
was done with Eric Dalheim.
Late Eric Dalheim.
Who was such, as we remember Eric Dalheim, to be such a wonderful man, such a wonderful collaborator, such a professional. And he was the one who took me under his arm when I first came on campus almost 10 years ago. And I did a number of recitals with him here and away. And I miss him terribly. And this is a great, I'm awfully glad you're playing this so we can remember him through this.
John Dee and Eric Dalheim. John is going to give a recital tomorrow night at the Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts with some other faculty colleagues. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. That's a tune by an anonymous Chinese composer, Lilies on the Mountainside, with oboist John Dee and pianist the late Eric Dalheim. Eric, formerly, of course, of University of Illinois faculty at the School of Music, and John Dee, still very much part of the U of I faculty. And he's going to be giving a recital tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Krannert Center in Urbana, joined by his colleagues in the Illinois Woodwind Quintet and also by the Jupiter Quartet, which is the string quartet in residence at the University of Illinois, and then by a little bit of a pickup group, I guess, called being called the Bach String Ensemble, mostly because it's going to be playing with him a piece by Johann Sebastian Bach, appropriately enough. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. Our programs today are made possible with the support of the Friends of WYLL and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, an agency of the state of Illinois. John Dee's my guest on Live and Local this hour. I mentioned some of your colleagues going to be performing on that recital, the Jupiter Quartet, for example. And you're doing a piece by with them by John Lennon, but I really should throw his middle initial in
there,
because it's John A. Lennon, to be distinguished from
right. The
John Lennon everybody knows of the Beatles.
John Lennon from the Beatles was born in 1940, and John A. Lennon was born in
1940. Actually, it says 1940 here.
Oh, does he 40?
Yeah.
Well, there we have it. But he's actually quite a cool guy, and I wish he was here. Unfortunately, he's making a move. He's on sabbatical right now from Emory University, where he's on faculty, composition faculty. But he's on sabbatical, moving into a house in California. So he said, "Please excuse me for not being there at this time, but things are a mess right now." And we certainly understand how things can be so busy, but we'll try to get him here another time. Wonderful guy, wonderful composer, wrote The Myth of Aeolia for me and the Vega String Quartet, who's in residence at the Emory University, and we premiered that in 2009. And I wanted to get that played here, and I could think of no finer group than the Jupiter, who my collaboration with them, Kevin, has been just out of sight. I guess that's why they're called the Jupiter. except the Jupiter is quite visible in most skies, but they are a wonderful group of nice people, hardworking, a beautiful work ethic, and I think people are really going to enjoy the piece. The piece is John Lennon himself called the piece an imagination. The composition is an exploration of the unknown music of the Aeolian archipelago. The listener is taken on a journey through the magnificence and grandeur of the myth. Not only is the myth an imagination, it is a journey, a dream, and an entrancing experience. And that sounds pretty flowerful, but it's interesting how the piece develops. It's a one-movement piece, and sort of, if you imagine the Big Bang theory, it's how almost dust particles, how they come together and they just start swirling around to create a melody and fragments. And it's tonal, it's always in motion, and it's a lot of fun. And I think we'll just have a blast doing it. In fact, something I should mention about the recital tomorrow night, for those who might be interested in coming out, it's going to be unusually short, and I think unusually fun. We're going to have three pieces, no intermission. Each piece is about 12 to 14 minutes long. A little explanation between pieces, but we'll be starting at 7:30, and by 8:30 we'll be in the lobby having a little reception. And I think it'll be a very accessible experience for anyone to enjoy. This first piece is, like I said, very tonal. The second piece is the premiere of a work that I and my colleague Tim McGovern, the bassoon professor, were a part of a commission by Bill Douglas to do a new woodwind quartet. And the final piece will be this 14 strings with harpsichord on the Bach A major D'Amore concerto. So we have three pieces and just a lot of variety of collaboration and music. So I think it'll be a lot of fun.
We don't have the John A. Lennon piece and recording, but just to hear an example of your own collaboration with string quartet, these are members of a group called the Tantalon Ensemble, in music by a guy who was almost exactly contemporary with Mozart. And Mozart wrote a very famous quartet for oboe and strings. This is also a quartet for oboe and strings.
Right.
By Franz Krummer, what was his name in Czech? Was František Kromer or something like that.
Well done, Kevin.
Yeah, something to that effect. Let's listen to the first movement of that. John D. is the oboist with the Tantalon Ensemble here on Live and Local. That was the opening movement by a quartet for oboe and strings by Franz Krummer, who is a contemporary of Mozart, and John D., the oboist, with members of the Tantalon Ensemble. A wonderful CD featuring John with ensemble members on the Clavier label. And actually, I personally recommend this label in general. It's spelled Klavier. You'd think it had nothing but piano music with a name like that. But in fact, I've seen very little piano music on it, although they may well have. It's a fantastic collection of music for wind ensemble, actually, on there, mostly courtesy of... and I'm going to start saying this, Eugene Corporon, the conductor. We've got a pretty good number of their recordings here at the radio station, and there's lots of gems of all kinds of music you can find there that I haven't found anywhere else. So that's just a personal recommendation from me, not only for this particular CD, but just in general, if you want to explore that label, K-L-A-V-I-E-R, Clavier. John D. is performing tomorrow night a work by John A. Lennon, not the Beatles' John Lennon, a piece called Myth of Aeola, Keepers of the Wind for Oboe and String Quartet, and the Jupiter String Quartet, who are in residence at the University of Illinois School of Music, where John is a faculty member, will be joining him for that piece. The recital is at the Kranitz Center tomorrow night at 7:30, and University of Illinois faculty recitals are quite inexpensive, so I wouldn't cost you much to go, and as John said, it won't take very long either.
No, the cost is $4 for students and $7 for seniors and $10 for anyone else. And I think it'll be a great value and a wonderful recital. So I'm encouraging everyone to come on out and enjoy about an hour experience, and then come out in the lobby and have a little get together, say hello. And I'm going to forego the reception line that goes down the hallway, down at the backstage area, and just say, come on out, everybody, and go out to the lobby, and let's meet out there, doing something a little different and mixing it up a little bit.
Yeah. This is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and our broadcast today is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's musical heritage at the University of Illinois, now featuring new exhibits entitled On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. More information is available at sousaarchives.org. John, you mentioned that on the program will be a new piece by a fellow named Bill Douglas, who was just born right around the corner from John A. Lennon. This piece, very cleverly titled Woodwind Quartet.
It's straightforward, Kevin. No fooling around. He's a interesting character. Bill Douglas is living out in Colorado now, and he might even be playing cello in the Colorado Symphony, but he's a bassoonist by training. He played in the Toronto Symphony and has done a lot of composing for double reeds. In fact, we have played his trio for oboe, bassoon, and piano here. And we just finished a new recording that'll be out in May, and it's for oboe, bassoon, and piano with my colleague Tim McGovern and Kara Chowning. on piano. And on that CD, we have a number of solo oboe pieces and bassoon pieces, in addition to two collaboratives, oboe, bassoon, and piano. And the solo piece, one of the solo pieces, four movements that I'm featuring, are four delightful. They're just called, I think they're called Easy Lyrical Pieces for Oboe and Piano by Bill Douglas. And they are very sweet. I think that it'll be an album that, or CD that people will enjoy listening to. It'll have a great appeal. But this Bill Douglas, he's been heavily influenced by jazz, and some of his models, you know, with some of his, you know, Miles Davis and John Coltrane, and he's really been, had a long-term, lifetime relationship with Stoltzman on clarinet, and he's toured around with him and written for him. And so he's based in jazz. And this piece is very jazzy. It has four movements, and he's basically written out what would be improvisatory type of riffs. And he has, it's kind of fun because he's applied it to what most people would consider a straight-laced classical woodwind quartet, oboe, flute, clarinet, and bassoon. But it works rather well. It's just fun. It's bouncy. It's enjoyable. And I think people will enjoy it.
We have, you said this is a premiere, right?
Yes, this actually is a premiere. It is a part of, we were a part of a commission that various people joined in on to get the piece written and get it out. And so it'll be, by being part of the commission, it's our premiere here in this town.
So that means there aren't any recorded performances yet. However, what we have is, for those of you who don't know that these things exist, they've gotten better, as you may hear. MIDI, and I don't remember what MIDI stands for. It's MIDI actually stands for something computer people will know. But it's basically electronic instruments. So composers can create and provide a MIDI file to performers who want to hear a piece that doesn't have a recording otherwise. And so he provided you with this, obviously.
Yes.
We have one of those.
And it'll be fun to listen to for people to hear it.
So it's a little without feeling, but it's also, the instruments sound relatively realistic, and you get an idea of what the piece will sound like.
Play it again, Sam, this time with feeling.
We will, that's right. Waltz Cantabile, the first movement of the Woodwind Quintet by Bill Douglas, that'll have its premiere tomorrow night at the Kranitz Center, with oboist John Dee and other members of the Illinois Woodwind Quintet.
Thank you.
In case you wondered what kind of instruments were playing there, the answer is a computer, really, or synthesized instruments. It's a MIDI file that represents the first movement of Bill Douglas's woodwind quintet, a waltz cantabile, it's called. And then the other three movements, Nocturne, Jubilation, and Allegro Cantando. That piece will have its premiere tomorrow night at 7:30 on a faculty recital featuring oboist John Dee. He is on faculty at the University of Illinois School of Music, as are the other performers who will be involved in that piece, his three colleagues in the woodwind division, flutist Jonathan Keeble, clarinetist J. David Harris, and bassoonist Timothy McGovern. John Dee's my guest on Live and Local today. And that recital tomorrow night at 7:30, which I may have just said, and I've already forgotten if I said that or not. The other piece that's on the program is a concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach for Oboe d'Amore, which is basically means, well, literally means the oboe of love.
Yes, and that's the feeling I have when I get to hear it played. It's a beautiful instrument. Bach loved it. He wrote for it probably mostly. Strauss wrote for it. Ravel wrote for it. It doesn't get performed very often. It's only a few pieces. Bach, like I said, probably wrote for it the most. He had great taste. What can I say? He knew what he was doing, and it's a beautiful instrument. It's placed right, but its length and characteristics are right between the oboe and the English horn. So the oboe is in C, like the flute or like the violin, and the English horn is an F lower, in a fifth lower, and is rich and warm. The oboe d'amore, the oboe of love, is right in between. So it's loving its position between the oboe and the English horn, and it's in the key of A. It looks like a little baby English horn. It's the cutest instrument, really. It's about 2 inches longer than the oboe, about 2 inches shorter than the English horn. It's got a little baby bocal, which is the conduit that comes out of the top of the instrument. It's a little curved piece of metal. It's about an inch long. And the reed, the oboe d'amore reed, goes onto it like it does onto the bassoon bocal or the English horn bocal. And it has a little swollen bell, like a little hollow egg bell. And it has fingerings that are the same as the oboe. But these are the three instruments that I play and I teach at the University of Illinois. And I have to teach the students to make oboe reeds, English horn reeds, and oboe d'amore reeds. So they are all made of the same type of wood, but different diameters, different gouges, different scrapes and lengths. So that's what they're busy doing in the reed studio at the University of Illinois, is making these reeds for the different instruments. They have to be tuned properly. And so you can't use one reed, doesn't fit all. So it's part of what we do to learn these instruments and the repertoire for these instruments.
Well, on the whole topic of reed making among double reed players, which is to say those three instruments you mentioned and the various members of the bassoon family,
yes.
Is I think you all spend as much time or more making reeds as you do in the practice room, probably. At least that's what it sounds like
sometimes. We do. That word came out last year, and we had two feature articles in newspapers, in the Illini newspaper and another postmarks that goes out to, 50,000 people or something, alumni of the University of Illinois. And with beautiful photographs that were taken by Brian Stauffer and Rusty Rhodes wrote the article, just with my students that were making reeds in the studio.
I remember reading that article, actually, now that you mention it.
Just, it was wonderful publicity for the School of Music and for the double reeds and the reed making, really for the students that spend, like you said, so much time learning the craft and the art of making reeds. Yeah.
And people have to make them. You said not every reed fits every purpose, nor does every reed fit every person.
Absolutely true.
Either literally or in matters of taste of what kind of sound you want.
It's very customized, and that's the type of thing that I try to teach them, is how to make those adjustments with the scrape of the knife. The diagrams or the internal structure of the reed is very important, and getting the reed balanced and in tune so the harmonics are proper. There's a lot that goes in it. As people know in the listening audience, the oboe is the instrument that tunes the symphony orchestra every day. And so our job to be the tuner is very, very important, that we put the read on that does give us the proper tone and dynamics and also the intonation. So it's part of the game, and it's something that a lot of people don't know about. So occasionally when we have the ability, thanks to you for getting on the air to mention that aspect of what we do, it is fun for people to learn that there's more to it than just learning the notes and how to wiggle your fingers.
And one can buy those things, but
they're pretty expensive. They're like $25 each. If you bought one, it may function, but like you said, it may not do the trick for the individual because each individual has a different dentistry, different lips, a different way of holding the reed in their mouth. We call that the embouchure, and blowing. Some people, like I might be able to blow. They might call me a blowhard. I can blow a lot of air and through that reed, and therefore I have to build a reed that has a different type of resistance in it through the scraping technique that I use, as opposed to one of my smaller students that maybe doesn't blow quite as strongly, and they have to build a different set of properties into that reed that is suitable to their needs. So it's quite a endeavor, but we take it seriously, and I'm so proud of my students here because they do it themselves. I don't supply them reeds. I certainly don't sell them reeds. I teach them how to do it, and that's what they need to know if they're going to continue on, and so many do, in the profession, and they can be independent. They can go anywhere at any time and know how to make a reed because they learned it here at the University of Illinois, and we're really proud of that.
Let's come back to the sort of a lead up to the Oboe d'Amore, because we're going to hear a movement of that concerto by Bach. But first, since you mentioned that it is sort of in between the oboe and the English horn, people will recognize the sound of the English horn even if they don't know the name of the English horn. It has such a characteristic sound, and to my ear, one of the most beautiful instrumental sounds that exists. And here is John Dee to make that sound in one of six short studies in English folk song, as they're called, by Ray Vaughan Williams. Arrangement here by Clark McAllister. And once again, it's John Dee with members of the Tantallon Ensemble. This is the first of those studies on English horn. The first of those six studies in English folk song by Ray Vaughan Williams, John Dee playing the English horn with members of the Tantallon Ensemble here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, where John is my guest this hour. And the Oboe d'Amore, which is the instrument, as he said, in between the sound of the English horn and the regular oboe, will be featured, played by John, of course, in the recital tomorrow night, in music by Johann Sebastian Bach. Does he have more than one concerto for this instrument? In fact, I'm not even sure I knew he had this concerto.
This is no, I don't think so. But the one of the reasons is, in this particular case, this was a reconstruction. It's such a beautiful work, and it is an original harpsichord concerto. So as often is the case, when something is so beautiful, like the English folk song we just listened to, which I think originally was for cello. And this Bach d'Amore concerto in A major was taken from the original harpsichord concerto. So Bach used his original writing for d'Amore was more centered around the cantatas with vocal interaction and such. But this is just a beautiful work, and I'm really glad to have Charlotte Maddox Mersch playing the harpsichord with the Bach Ensemble tomorrow night in the recital at the Krannert Center, because she has played this particular work as a harpsichord concerto. So it'll be fun for at least she indicates to me, it'll be fun for her to do it in this version, and fun for me to have her there right behind me all the way in the recital.
So is this one of those pieces where Bach rearranged his own music, or was this arranged by somebody
no,
else?
No, this was done by somebody else.
Because he did that with a lot of his pieces.
He did. I believe this was done by someone else later on, and with great care to stick to the original text. So it's very authentic, and it's been recorded quite a few times, actually, by oboists through the ages playing the Demore, because it does work well.
Let's give a listen to the final movement of this concerto. This is a performance that features Stephen Hammer on the oboe Demore with the Bach Ensemble. Now, I got to make a distinction here. In our community, there's an organization called the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana who use the acronym of Bach as their name. This is not that ensemble,
not
either
all.
In the recording or playing tomorrow.
Correct.
Just to for anybody who
but this just to yeah, and just to
confused.
Expand on that, Kevin, the ensemble that I have, that I've cloned the Bach Ensemble,
the Bach string ensemble.
String ensemble. Thank you. Yeah. Is made up of Igor Kalinin, for example, who's the concertmaster of the Prairie Ensemble and the
Champaign-Urbana
Symphony. A wonderful colleague there, Aaron Jacobs, Rudolf Hocken, Ben Hayek, some of the lead players in this ensemble. And so they're really recognized figures throughout the area in our ensembles and some of the best professionals we have. So,
and they play in lots of different groups.
Yeah, and so I'm really so grateful, as a matter of fact. A lot of people don't know how these things work. I put out the word that I might want to play this concerto, and I just have to say, without their support, they get nothing for doing this. It's all an act of love. They do it just to collaborate with me, and that goes for the Jupiter and the U of I Wind faculty. It's just wonderful how we all come to each other's aid and are out there doing it really for the love of music and putting our time and effort in. So I want to just a shout out of thank you to all my colleagues that are making this recital tomorrow night at the Krannert Center a possibility.
And that recital starts at 7:30. It'll be in the Follinger Great Hall at the Krannert on the campus of the University of Illinois in Urbana. Oboist and oboe d'amoreist. Oboist d'amore? How do you say that?
That sounds very good the way you say it. I'd go for any of that.
All right, fine.
Late for dinner.
John D. with the Jupiter Quartet, the Illinois Woodwind Quintet, and the Bach String Ensemble. And John, I want to say many thanks to you for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Kevin, for making it possible. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And here's that final movement of Bach's, the Bach Oboe Concerto, Oboe d'Amore Concerto, Stephen Hammer, the soloist with the Bach Ensemble, and director Joshua Rifkin. That's the final movement of the Concerto for Oboe d'Amore, Strings and Continuo by Johann Sebastian Bach. Stephen Hammer, the soloist with the Bach Ensemble, directed by Joshua Rifkin. This is Live and Local. Our program is made possible with support from the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming back audience favorite, the Joshua Redman Quartet, to perform an evening of virtuosic and vibrant jazz on Thursday, November 21st at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit krannertcenter.com. You're listening to 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. WYL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.